Welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. Today we'll look at a number of subjects in the news. We'll begin in a moment and speak with Flint Leverett, who's a senior fellow at the New American Foundation. Formerly, he was a senior director of Middle East Affairs on the National Security Council and formerly a senior analyst on the Middle East at the Central Intelligence Agency. He was censored recently by the White House. He tried to submit an op-ed piece to the New York Times, and the White House censored it, even though the content that was censored was the very content I discussed last week on this program with Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson, the former Chief of Staff to Secretary of State Colin Powell. So we'll be looking into the White House censoring information about what basically covering up their incompetence using national security. And then we'll speak with William Arkin, who is a columnist for the Washington Post. He's an NBC military analyst and the author of Codenames, Deciphering U.S. Military Plans, Programs, and Operations in the 9/11 World. We'll be talking to Bill Arkin about the White House's plans to increase the size of the Army and the Marines, as well as this so-called military surge in Iraq, at a very point where the American people voted to get out of Iraq. The White House appears to be getting further in. I'm speaking with Flint Leverett, who is a senior fellow at the New America Foundation, formerly a senior director of Middle East Affairs at the National Security Council, and formerly a senior analyst on the Middle East at the Central Intelligence Agency. And this week, Flint, you've been on all of the television because you wrote an op-ed piece for the New York Times, and it was essentially censored by the White House. You have to, under your secrecy agreements that you signed when you work for the government, you have to submit all manuscripts, and apparently you submitted this, I take it that the CIA passed on it, or at least approved it. But, well, why don't you tell the story?
Well, I think you've got the basic factual frame right. As a former CIA employee, I have an obligation before I publish anything to show it to the agency, the Publication Review Board at the CIA, so that they can determine that the draft doesn't, in fact, contain or reveal classified information. And I have, since leaving government 3.5 years ago, I've put, something on the order of 30 different pieces of varying lengths through that process. The CIA has never asked to change a word, and they've always said, my pieces do not reveal classified information. They even said this for a longer paper on U.S. policy toward Iran that I published a couple weeks ago through the Century Foundation. My wife, who's also a former government employee, and I drafted an op-ed for the New York Times based on this longer paper. Contains no additional information, no new details or anything of that sort. Based on the longer paper, which the agency had cleared without changing a word, and when I sent this op-ed in for clearance, the agency told me that, as far as they were concerned, it didn't contain classified information, but that the White House had now complained that the CIA was clearing my pieces without letting the White House take a look at them and edit and impose their own edits in the process. And so the CIA said it had to defer to the White House. And even though their judgment had been that it contained no classified information, when the White House came back and was excising whole paragraphs from the draft on the grounds that it contained classified information, they said they were going to defer to that. And that would be their position as well, and that I was not free to publish. I can tell you categorically the paragraphs that were excised by the White House do not contain classified information. I have provided reams of documentation to the CIA that the material discussed in those paragraphs has been amply reported in the media. It has been discussed openly by senior U.S. officials, including Secretary Rice and former Secretary of State Powell. It has been written about by me in publications that were cleared fully by the agency. And for them to come in at this point and basically try and block me from publishing an op-ed in the New York Times that would be very, very critical of the administration, and would not just be critical, but would document how the administration has systematically bungled multiple opportunities to put relations with Iran on a better trajectory, that this is just abuse of the process, politicization of another aspect of intelligence, and it was unacceptable. And so I have gone public with my criticism of the way that the White House is abusing and politicizing this process, and the way that the CIA is falling over and abetting it.
And as of this moment, what has been the White House's reaction? Have they retracted? And the New York Times is essentially standing by, right?
New York Times is ready to publish whenever my wife and I would tell them that we have a piece that's cleared for publication. The White House continues to insist that it has a right to censor my pieces, and it is continuing to make not just a false claim, but a fraudulent claim that the passages they are excising contain classified information.
Well, if they contain classified information, then the White House had better come after me, because last week on my radio show I had Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson on, describing the very, at least in part, what the White House has censored from your op-ed piece, Flint Leavitt. Larry Wilkerson spoke about how on around April the 10th of 2003, when the statue of Saddam was toppled, the Iranians and the Syrians approached the White House through back channels and told the leadership that they wanted to discuss everything. Everything was on the table. The authority to discuss it came from the Supreme Leader, and they were quaking in their boots, expecting the United States to topple them next. And this was a moment of maximum leverage that we had over the Iranians and the Syrians, where they wanted to deal, and instead Vice President Cheney showed them the door and told them, we don't talk to evil.
So, Colonel Wilkerson has that exactly right, and it underscores my point that the episodes I'm discussing in this op-ed are public knowledge. What the White House doesn't want at this point is for an op-ed to appear in the leading newspaper in the English-speaking world, the New York Times, and to have it appear from two people, namely my wife and myself, both of whom worked on these issues for this administration during the first term. My wife was one of two U.S. officials who regularly met with Iranian counterparts for almost 2 years. During this period. And because of our experience, we would have, and I hope I'm not sounding too immodest in this, but we would have, I think, very unique credibility, very unique standing to tell people just how badly the Bush administration has bungled this this issue, and at a time when the White House is under maximum political pressure to change course in the Middle East, they do not want this coming out. In fact, they don't want to change course on Iran, they may be setting the stage to go in a completely different direction and move toward military action
against Iran.
Yes.
And who is would it be the point man for the on the NSC behind this in terms of censoring your work?
I honestly don't know who the NSC official is who contacted the CIA and demanded that the White House be allowed to censor my pieces. I've been told by the agency, and both agency and NSC officials have admitted this to journalists this week, that the White House did insert itself into the process for my pieces. I don't know specifically what individual at the White House delivered that message to the CIA. I do know that the policy people at the NSC who signed off on the deletions would be people who work for Elliot Abrams, Megan O'Sullivan, and Michael Duran. Elliot Abrams and Megan O'Sullivan are both politically appointed deputy national security advisors to the president, and Michael Duran is a politically appointed senior director for Middle East Affairs.
Yes, I actually know Michael Duran, and he comes from Princeton, out of somewhat a protege, I believe, of the Princeton Middle East expert, Bernard. Is it Bernard Lewis?
Bernard Lewis.
Yes. So you haven't been able to contact these people directly.
I haven't tried to contact these people directly.
Well, is the Times trying to do it? I mean, in other words, what recourse do you have?
We are currently, reviewing what our options are for pushing this issue and getting redress. We haven't taken any decisions at this point about how to proceed, but we're examining all of the options, legal and otherwise, available to us. And, we'll make some decisions in short order about how to proceed.
And having gone public, do you feel that there's sufficient outrage? I mean, it seems to me this is a blatant example of how secrecy is being used by a government to cover up its incompetence in the name of national security.
That's exactly what it is. And I'm very gratified that there's been as much press coverage as there has been. I'm told that at least one congresswoman, a very senior Democrat, Louise Slaughter from New York, has already written to the White House asking for an accounting of what transpired. I think maybe in the coming weeks there will be more inquiries of that sort.
But I'm sure our audience, Flint Leverett, are wondering how come they heard this last week on last Sunday from Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson, and they can't read it in the New York Times written by you.
Because I think, frankly, they are less worried, and no disrespect to you, Ian, they are less worried about, a one-time interview,
right,
with an NPR affiliate, even in a large market like Los Angeles,
than
they are
KPFK
about a permanent hard copy op-ed. Right. In the leading newspaper record in the English-speaking world.
I see. Well, this is KPFK Los Angeles, a small radio station. I would have thought the journalistic world should get behind this. I mean, isn't this a vital principle? And we're not even talking about anonymous sources here. There's nothing
right.
anonymous
that's
about
right.
you.
We're not. We're basically talking about letting former government officials write about things that are already in the public domain. And so far there have been sizable articles on this in several major newspapers: the New York Times, Washington Post, Financial Times, the L.A. Times, UPI has done a story, other newspapers have done a story, several newspapers are coming out and editorializing against what the White House has done. I certainly feel like I've been obliged to spend most of my week on TV or radio interviews talking about this. And I think attention is being paid to it.
Well, let's since the White House doesn't want the American people to know what you're writing about, and albeit we're not the New York Times here, but give us a sense then of what it is that they are most afraid of.
Essentially, the largest excisions from the draft. I mean, the places in the draft where they are excising whole paragraphs deal with two basic topics. One is the fact that after the 9/11 attacks, the United States and Iran had a sustained, ongoing, effectively a bilateral dialogue between the two countries concerning Afghanistan, and concerning related issues, the problem of Al-Qaeda operatives trying to flee Afghanistan, for example. All of these issues were on the table. There were regular meetings between U.S. and Iranian officials to coordinate approaches to this. This was a very, very productive dialogue. And the Iranians believed that it was a real opportunity that by helping the United States in the aftermath of the 9/11 attacks, that we would ultimately come to see them in a somewhat different light. That's not the payoff that the Iranians got from it. Instead, what they got was to be labeled part of the axis of evil in the president's January 2002 State of the Union address. And even when they continued helping us for more than a year after that, finally to have us cut the talks off in May of 2003. The second topic that the White House doesn't want us mentioning, at least in this op-ed, is the fact that in the spring of 2003, as Colonel Wilkerson told you and your listeners, the Iranians sent in a proposal basically for to negotiate a comprehensive grand bargain that would resolve all of the major outstanding differences between the United States and Iran, and the Bush administration categorically rejected that offer, didn't even want to explore it or consider it.
And, of course, this was a moment when the United States had maximum leverage over the Iranians.
Yeah, we had maximum leverage, and also if you look at where things were just in Iran, you know, Iran had been cooperating with us very well in Afghanistan. Afghanistan was a lot more stable than it is today. Lebanese Hezbollah was relatively restrained. Iran was not spinning centrifuges. Iran was not enriching uranium. And the president of Iran was Mohammad Khatami, not Mahmoud Ahmadinejad.
And we had obviously done the Iranians an enormous favor by getting rid of the Taliban. They almost went to war with the Taliban and lost, I believe, a number of senior Iranian intelligence officers were murdered by the Taliban.
That's right. That's correct. But I think it is really a mistake to say that the Iranians helped us in Afghanistan simply because of their animosity toward the Taliban. They could have stood aside and let us eliminate the Taliban, basically like they remained neutral during the first Gulf War when we were driving Saddam out of Kuwait. But they decided that they wanted to come forward and offer to help us in multiple ways in Afghanistan, because they thought that that would be the key to starting a process of improving relations with us. Their fundamental objective in Afghanistan and helping us there was not primarily about Afghanistan, it was about us. And we blew that opportunity.
And, of course, the tables have turned now. Iran has tremendous leverage over us because we're vulnerable in Iraq. They're also, we've seen from the war that Israel had against the Hezbollah that the Hezbollah has become kind of a, you know, the champions of the Arab world, and Iran is becoming a hegemonic threat, in effect, to the Sunni states, all of whom are incredibly nervous.
That's right, and it is a really sorry record of missed opportunities and ever greater strategic costs that are being imposed on America's position in this very, very important part of the world. Because of very, very fundamental and utterly avoidable blunders that this administration has made.
And what about reports that the Iranians were offering high-value targets to be handed over, including bin Laden's son, who was captured coming in from Afghanistan?
Yes. This actually occurred after I left government, but I have it on very, very good authority from the Iranian side, and people in the know on the U.S. side have confirmed it for me, that Iran, in fact, did offer to trade some Al-Qaeda operatives, including apparently some very, very senior figures that were in Iran, to trade those for leaders of the Mujahideen-e-Khalq which is an Iranian opposition group that we, the United States government, has designated a foreign terrorist organization. It was, in effect, you know, we'll give you your terrorists, we want our terrorists. And in the Bush administration, though, was unwilling to consider that offer, even though, as I said, the MEK has long been designated by the U.S. government as a foreign terrorist organization.
And the MEK is simply of no value to the United States, since they are totally discredited within Iran itself. They've been sheltered by Saddam.
I would certainly agree with that assessment. Unfortunately, there appear to be civilians at the Pentagon and in the office of the vice president who think that somehow the MEK might be useful as part of a strategy of regime change in Iran. But these are the same people who thought that Ahmad Chalabi was the key to post-Saddam success in Iraq. So, I mean, I think their track record at understanding and evaluating these things is pretty clear.
And that, of course, is a track record that they don't want, apparently want their public to talk about. And on the second issue, then, which we spoke with Colonel Wilkerson, the how do they justify this, the situation now? I mean, this week, and just a couple of days ago, the president talked about increasing soldiers, troops. They're talking about a military surge, and not to mention increasing the overall troop strength. Of course, that won't come online till about 2009. So, in many ways, that's a public relations move.
Yeah,
but. You mentioned earlier, Flint Leverett, that you thought that one of the reasons they're censoring you at the White House is that they do have other plans for Iran, not to negotiate, which is what the Baker-Hamilton Commission has called for, but in fact military action. Given that the United States, the Bush regime, this current administration have already lost one war in Iraq, they are now in the process of losing a second war in Afghanistan. It defies logic that they would start and initiate a third war with a country that could really do us some damage, and a war that we would surely lose, and that may in fact ignite the passions of 1.3 billion Muslims.
I absolutely agree. I think it would be disastrous for U.S. interests in the region and elsewhere if the Bush administration goes down this road. There will be some powerful voices within the decision-making circles arguing against it, not least the uniformed military, who understand what some of the consequences of this could be for example, U.S. troops in Iraq if we were to attack Iran. But there are also, you know, very, very powerful voices in the administration, including the vice president, who are arguing for this. I think the president himself is fundamentally unwilling to come to any strategic rapprochement with the Islamic Republic of Iran, and will continue pushing for some sort of sanctions resolution in the UN Security Council. But whatever the Security Council might ultimately agree on, I can guarantee you it will be trivial and in no way leverage change in Iranian behavior. And so we're going to be looking at a window, you know, anywhere from, you know, 3 months to 6 months down the road moving forward, in which the president has no Security Council option to speak of to try and pressure Iran. And he, because he won't pursue serious diplomacy with Iran, he's basically left with the choice of, from his perspective, doing nothing as Iran continues to develop its nuclear capabilities, or acting, in his view, decisively to try and delay development of those capabilities. And in that scenario, I think the risks that this president will choose military action, those risks are not trivial.
Well, arguably, we already have a surrogate war in Iraq, albeit a war that we appear to have already lost, and the president because of his own prestige is tied up in this, doesn't seem to want to admit his own failures and pull the plug.
And in that sense, attacking Iran could be part of the exit strategy for Iraq. And it also feeds in to, I think, the view of the vice president and others in the administration that, you know, it's important for the United States to demonstrate to Iran that, quote unquote, we're not going to be pushed around like this in Iraq or in other arenas.
But surely, Flint Leverett, I understand there's an element of reckless utopianism here amongst the neoconservatives, and they're still, in spite of the manifest failures of their policies, they still appear to be entrenched in the vice president's office. And now you have Kagan's, the American Enterprise Institute, which is the sort of font, if you will, of neoconservatism. They've got a new plan for Iraq, a new military plan, the so-called surge. So you have this strange situation where a discredited group of ideologues are in fact still in charge of U.S. foreign policy. But do you believe that anybody there gets it in the fundamental sense that an attack on Iran, rather than liberate the Iranian people from this odious regime that we all agree is a terrible regime, they will in fact drive them into the arms of the mullahs, and that prior to our invasion in Iraq, there was evidence that you could split the Iranian people from the mullahs?
As I said, I think that to the extent there will be a really steady voice at the table arguing the case against this, I think it is most likely to be the uniformed military. Now, the top levels of the uniformed military, I don't believe, acquitted themselves very well in the advice and counsel that they gave to the president in the run-up to the war on Iraq or in the post-conflict period. But there does seem to be an awareness at high levels in the uniformed military of the many, many downsides to pursuing a military campaign against Iran's nuclear infrastructure. And I hope that those arguments will be forcefully articulated and that in the end they will be dispositive, but we will have to wait and see.
And we know from the experiences of Colonel Wilkerson that Colin Powell, his boss, essentially got rolled by Cheney. And Condoleezza Rice was in no way a help to him, and she still appears to be in no way a help. There's nobody in the policy in the cabinet at the cabinet level that you can count on. It's just the generals themselves who are already overstretched, overcommitted, and realize that if you take on Iran, then they can cause us so much more grief than we can cause them.
My experience working for Dr. Rice, when she was a national security advisor, is that she was really a very, very weak performer in that role, and certainly, did not exercise the kind of stewardship over the policy process that one would expect from a national security advisor in the run-up to a decision to go to war. I hope that she might do better in her current position as Secretary of State, but I'm personally not optimistic about that. Mr. Gates, we simply don't know enough yet about his inclinations as Defense Secretary, and if he does have some inclinations against military action toward Iran, how willing he is to be a forceful voice against that course.
But the bottom line is that, as far as we know, Dick Cheney seems to be in charge.
I've always argued that reports early in the second term about the demise of the neocons and Cheney's eclipse were premature and greatly exaggerated. That these forces, these constituencies in the administration remain very powerful, very influential.
On that pessimistic note, I must leave you, and I thank you so much for joining us in Los Angeles.
Thanks very much, Ian. Good to be with you.
Have a happy holidays.
Thanks, you too.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Hello again, I'm Ian Masters. I was just speaking then with Flint Leverett, who's a senior fellow at the New American Foundation and a former senior director of Middle East Affairs on the National Security Council, and he was also a former senior analyst on the Middle East at the CIA. I'm now speaking with William Arkin, who's a columnist for the Washington Post. He's NBC's a military analyst, and he's the author of Codenames, Deciphering U.S. Military Plans, Programs, and Operations in the 9/11 World. And just in touching, before we get into the meat of the discussion about the president's plans for a new military and for this so-called military surge in Iraq, in your book, Codenames, you covered an enormous index of U.S. military, the projection of U.S. military power throughout the world. And it's a sobering a look at this vast military empire that spans the globe and has actions in about 180 countries. So how do you square that with the idea that you constantly hear now that our military is broken? So how could it be encompassing the globe on the one hand and broken at home?
Well, Ian, my car is broken. It has a scratch on the right passenger side door. It has a puncture in the bumper, and I've driven it just fine for the last few years. But if somebody wants to throw some money at me, I'd be happy to have a new one. So, I mean, I see the military in a similar way, in the sense that yes, it's broken in terms of stretched to its limits and in combat forces being deployed to Iraq, multiple rotations on the part of a limited number of soldiers in Iraq, Afghanistan, Horn of Africa, and elsewhere, as well as having to keep up all of its commitments in Europe, Bosnia, the Korean Peninsula. So, yes, broken, but I put that broken into quotations because it just depends upon what it is that we want. Do we want a shiny new car, or is it the fact indeed that we are at war and that this is what is to be expected, that we're not going to be able to provide the pristine conditions for all of our soldiers under arms?
Well, but isn't there, you know, just at the very macro level, isn't there a problem here that we are spending more money on the military than the rest of the world combined, and yet our ability to deter our enemies is diminishing, and we are losing one, we've already lost one war in Iraq, we're in the process of losing another one in Afghanistan, and our previous guest, who was a Middle East expert on Iran at the National Security Council at the CIA, who's having being censored by the White House, he's saying that one of the reasons they're censoring him is that actually Dick Cheney has plans to attack Iran. So there's a third war that we could lose as well.
Well, I do think that the fact that we spend $500 billion a year on our military and seem to produce combat power that is only useful for one purpose and doesn't seem to address the real challenges that we face when we're out there in the world should be something that most Americans should be very concerned about. Hey, we have the best Air Force and the best Navy in the world, and they are fantastic at destroying things, at mobilizing themselves, at communicating, at networking. Those are all the expensive parts of the American military. But the fact of the matter is that the percentage of the defense budget that goes to the Army and the Marine Corps hasn't changed one bit since 9/11, and those forces are starved, and the ones that are needed the most are the least sexy and thereby probably the least able to address the real challenges that we have in front of us. So some aspects of the American military are fabulous, and that's why the United States was able to topple Saddam Hussein and 22 days. That's why the United States was able to defeat the Taliban in Afghanistan in a short 2 weeks after it began bombing in October 2001. And yet, it couldn't transition from those conventional military victories to attaining security, and that is the gap within our military capabilities. And unfortunately, it's not the sexy part of the American military, and nor is it the area where we do very well.
But it seems, though, the immature and impetuous use of our military power by political authorities who haven't thought things through it may be the problem here, because once you make a strategic blunder, it's almost like original sin. There's no tactical fix to that inherent mistake.
Well, I think that there is evidence to support the notion that our hyper capability in military conventional terms is a very seducing element to decision makers going to war. In some cases, I guess even liberals would say that's a good thing. The Kosovo War in 1999, completely and utterly a war of choice. And the Clinton administration probably was seduced into believing that it could undertake a humanitarian intervention because the military was so competent and capable. Afghanistan, of course, was not a war of choice per se, Ian, you know that, but mm-hmm. Iraq certainly was. And there were probably a number of dynamics, unfinished business on the part of those who were in power in the White House, the weapons of mass destruction nightmare, even if it was a deception, and finally one that I think most people probably overlook is that we were finishing up a war in Afghanistan where we had built up a significant presence and capability in the Gulf region, and probably clever people in the Pentagon said, why bring them home? Why don't we get a twofer out of what we have achieved in Afghanistan? And maybe because they were so impressed with the conventional military victory and believed that Afghanistan was really finished and that they could move on, and believed their own self-deceptions that Iraqis would shower the Americans with praise in the streets of Baghdad and elsewhere, decided to make use of that military while it was still in the area. So I think that there is an argument to be made that our military is so good at some things that it often is a seductive element of making a decision to use force. But I also think at the same time that sometimes the reality is that the United States uses its military for the right reasons, but just does not have the cultural sensitivity and the political flexibility that's necessary in the modern world. And the reason is as much to do with the fact that the military is a blunt instrument as it is to do with the failures of the military itself.
And you wouldn't then suggest that that the commander in chief is the real issue here, because if you have a president as you did with Eisenhower, who was a former military man, Kennedy, who served in the war, Nixon, who also served in the war, Johnson, who didn't, who ended up his presidency was lost over Vietnam. It seems to me that the military, by nature, are a can-do operation. So you tell them, you know, they're always ready to go and do things. But
well, I there's no question, Ian, that this president in particular seems to be befuddled by the world, and is not a good example of either civilian leadership or experience. You know, but having said that, the reason why our country is what it is and the reason why our Constitution is written the way it is because we, in theory, have a balance of powers. And so before I merely lament Cheney and Bush's power, I also have to really address the question of congressional abrogation of its role and responsibility. The president has essentially been able to do whatever he's wanted to do in the field of national security since 9/11, and the United States Congress has let him do that. So I can't say that I believe that this is all the White House's fault. I think that there's enough blame to go around, and I hate the tendency that we have grown into in the post 9/11 world of defending the CIA or defending the uniformed military against the big bad Cheneys of the world, because these wonderful institutions need our protection against the bad guys. Hey, you know what? These are bureaucracies. These are institutions of the government with their own interests, with their competence and incompetence. And I don't think that the CIA or the military needs to be defended. I think the reality is that there's just an enormous amount of blame to go around. We have reacted to 9/11 over a period of 6 years now badly. We have constantly said that we want to achieve non-military goals, that we want to, that the solution to peace and to the war against terrorism is as much non-military as military, and yet every day we wake up and really all we do is military in nature.
And indeed, the very rubric, the very structure of our these military activities are this so-called war on terror, which the president declared a couple of days after 9/11, and that's been the unifying principle of his administration. And yet, in its fundamentals, it's a very flawed concept. It's been very good for him politically. It's made him a wartime president, and he won a couple of elections because of that. But it's been the most counterintuitive way to fight the war on terror, this big footprint that we have. And today, just yesterday, at his Wednesday on his press conference, he was talking about the war on terror again and how we needed to build this new army to fight this long, long war on terror. So we're stuck with the war on terror, it seems, and the opposition, the political opposition who allowed this canard to be floated, are still incredibly passive.
Well, it seems to me that we have even a worse situation than you describe, Ian, because the Democratic Party, in its opposition to the war in Iraq, has tended to embrace the war against terrorism as the alternative. And so the argument used in the 2004 elections and in the 2006 elections were, if we would just resolve the Iraq problem, we would be able to focus more attention on Afghanistan and the war against terrorism. And the connotation there, of course, is that the war against terrorism necessitates the same kind of military efforts that we're doing in Iraq. And so it presents the public with a false picture of both the problem and the solution. I think the Democrats have sort of, this is a case of sadomasochism here. They've bound themselves up into this argument, and now they are going to have a hell of a time getting out of it. But the truth of the matter is that across Washington, as we saw recently with the Iraq Study Group, the Baker-Hamilton Commission, there is a consensus about the war on terrorism that I would guess goes unchallenged for the very reason that we have been so immersed in Iraq. And I imagine that once the Iraq war is over, that people will start asking serious questions as to what exactly this war on terrorism is.
William Arkin, in terms of the president's new plan for the military that he floated, it sort of smacks to me yet again of sort of Rovian public relations, because the military buildup that he's talking about is not going to affect the Iraq war. Nothing's going to come online, if they can find the money, which is a big if, until about 2009.
Well, there is a political gambit associated with this notion of increasing the size of the Army and the Marine Corps. I guess I see it in three pieces. One is it's a payoff of the Army and the Marine Corps themselves. It's sort of saying to the generals, look, you help us in the short term in terms of our policy and pursuits in Iraq, and we'll help you in the long term in increasing the end strength and permanent troop size of your services. So what general then is going to stand up and say, oh, no thanks, I don't need more and don't want more? Second, it's a bit of a gambit against the Congress. Congress itself, the Democrats themselves campaigned in 2004 and 2006 that the Army needed to be larger. I mean, that was John Kerry's platform in 2004. And so now they're being faced with the prospects of having to prove it and pay for it. And even if they ask the question, well, what are these forces actually going to do and where are they going to go, and just even the practical questions, they'll be branded as soft on national security and anti-American troops. And so it's a brilliant move against the Congress because it sort of forces them to capitulate to the president. The American people, on the other hand, are sort of confused because the president, in the same week, is discussing a surge in the short term of American forces in Iraq, as well as a permanent increase in the size of American forces. Well, the truth of the matter is, Ian, we are successful in Iraq militarily to increase the size of American forces in the long term. And if we are going to withdraw from Iraq, which I think we are, then we don't need to increase the size of our forces either, because...
I'm afraid we just had a little bit of a phone interference there. Could you just recap that, what you just said there? I think you're saying that the military surge vis-a-vis Iraq, by the time they get through it, that Iraq is going to be over at any rate.
Well, one needs to understand, Ian, the difference between the so-called surge of forces and the permanent increase in forces. The two are in some ways not connected at all, but yet in another way are very much connected. Look, if the Bush administration is going to be successful at surging forces and thereby going to be successful at transitioning from an American military combat role to an advisory role and then the eventual withdrawal of U.S. forces with victory, then we don't need to increase the size of American forces because we will have alleviated the strain which is currently affecting the Army and the Marine Corps. The reason for the Army and the Marine Corps to be strained is because of these constant rotations in and out of Iraq. If the Democrats and the American public are successful in pressuring and forcing the administration indeed to withdraw from Iraq and to find an exit strategy, then we also don't need to increase the size of our forces because we will have alleviated the reasons why there is such strain on the Army and the Marine Corps today. So, what is this increase about? China, North Korea, Iran fighting another war? I think the answer is no. It's about paying off the generals and paying off the armed forces for suffering under the Iraq War and under Rumsfeld. And in that regard, I can only see it as a cynical political ploy on the part of the Bush administration.
But adding to this cynicism, William Arkin, is the fact that it doesn't seem to be connected to reality. How are we going to pay for any of this stuff? Because this war in Iraq is about a half a trillion so far. It could end up $1 or $2 trillion. You've got replacement costs for all the equipment that's burned, the Army and the Marines have burned through. I believe it's close to about $75 billion now. I don't know how we're going to continue with all these big ticket items like the joint strike fighter, the F-22 Raptor, all the submarines, etc. In fact, recently, an Army general, former head of the National Security Council, Bill Odom, was on the program, making the point that the Navy has been taking the lion's share of the money over the years, and the Navy basically is just a big boondoggle protecting the dolphins, but the Army. His
well complete... said by an Army general,
exactly.
I might point out too, Ian.
I pointed that out, that he is an Army general. But I think there is clearly, there's clearly been a lot of money has gone for Cold War platforms, and not enough money has gone for the new subnational and transnational threats that we face.
Well, you know, to some degree, I think that you're absolutely right, and to some degree, you're wrong. Look, the reality is our defense spending today is ballooned out of control. And it, for all the money that we're spending in Iraq, let me just make it clear, Ian. My 12-year-old daughter says to me when she watches the news with me, why don't we just pay the Iraqis this $7 billion a month that we're spending in Iraq to solve their own problem? And, you know, talk about the emperor has no clothes. I mean, this is a pretty simple point. We are really good at spending huge amounts of money. But the reality also is that we can afford to do so. There's nothing in our economy. There's nothing in the American public's day-to-day lives. There's nothing in the stock market. There's nothing in this holiday season which would indicate in any way that America can't afford to spend even more on the military. That's just the reality. And when the Americans feel the pinch, I'm sure that they will also feel compelled to get involved in the fact that 7 out of 10 Americans oppose the war in Iraq, and yet nobody can take to the streets. And so that is one reality of our defense spending. The other reality of the defense spending, and I think where you're a little bit wrong, Ian, is that, yes, it may be true that the Navy is chasing dolphins and the Air Force is, has nobody to bomb this week. But the defense dollar, what we spend on defense, is mostly going these days towards information technology, towards IT. In fact, I think I read somewhere recently that 40% of the defense budget is now software and IT and networking and communications. And it, in a way, it's what binds everybody together. It's why if you have a loved one in Iraq or Afghanistan, you know that you can get on email with them every night. You can watch them on a webcam. And we have that bizarre intimacy and closeness on the one hand, and on the other hand, they're half a world away. And so what we spend our money on, not how much we spend, but what we spend it on, really is what is in need of radical change. And I'm afraid that there is not a Democrat that I can see who is even close to recommending that. Now, again, it may just be because we are overwhelmed by Iraq, but I would really hope that in the 2008 election, we would, for the first time, begin to discuss in the post-Cold War period just what kind of a military we really want to need.
Well, William Archer, you may well have hit the nail on the head here, because I was talking with last week with Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson, Colin Powell's chief of staff and former military man, and he said, he agreed with me that the fact is, the matter is that it's only the Marines and the Army that are fighting the war in Iraq. It's obscene. The American people aren't involved. It's a distant, for a while it was an amusement and a highly rated TV show. Now it's a sort of, it's depressing, but nobody's really connected. And the fact of the matter is that there are 100,000 contractors over there making a lot of money, including the vice president's former company. There doesn't seem to be enough outrage on the part of the American people that here you have contractors making money out of a war that we've lost, that nobody's going to win from. And you'd think in the real world that if you were able to make all this money out of the Treasury and not even win the goddamn war, I mean, what is going on here?
Well, look, there is outrage in one sense. The American public did vote in November overwhelmingly and does believe overwhelmingly, according to every poll, that the Iraq war is wrong, that the president is wrong, and that we want out. I find it fascinating, however, that since November we've now had, 5-6 weeks, and there has been a move to increase the size of our forces in Iraq and extend the war. The public spoke. It said what it wanted. And yet Washington is, on both sides of the aisle, thwarting that popular sentiment. That to me, is the greatest irony of what's going on now inside the Beltway.
Well, just in closing then, William Arkin, it seems that maybe our previous guest, Flint Leverett, who is the National Security Council's Middle East expert on Iran and former senior analyst on the Middle East and Iran at the CIA, he thinks that maybe the reason that they've censored him is because the White House has censored him is because they still have plans to attack Iran. And now we're learning that our military, our special forces, are in Ethiopia training the Ethiopians to fight the Somalis, and there's a possibility of a civil war in Somalia breaking out at any moment. So out there in the world that you wrote about in Codenames, deciphering U.S. military plans, programs, and operations in the 9/11 world, the nose of the camel is already under the tent.
Well, to some degree it is. Look, here's the dynamic in Washington, Ian. National security is men's work. It's the one area in which the president has almost unlimited powers. For a wide variety of reasons, the president has acquired more and more capabilities and powers in the field of national security. And if nothing else, it proves to be the most important trump card for any element of governance. And so it is a heady atmosphere of being the geopolitical master of the world and pushing pins in Ethiopia and Somalia and Iran and North Korea and Iraq and elsewhere is the favorite activity of those who are in charge of the government. I just think that's sort of the psychological dynamic. And even a president like Bill Clinton, who wasn't particularly skilled or even compelled and in the field of national security, became seduced in Bosnia and Kosovo and elsewhere because of the feelings associated with national security and governance. So really, what is needed here is greater pressure upon those who are in the counter institutions, really in the Congress, to say to them, you know, look, we voted a certain way, and we expect a result. We expect the Congress to say without compromise to the President of the United States that we demand an exit strategy and we demand a withdrawal. That is what the American people want. And if we have to pay the price 5 or 10 years from now, like the government is saying we will, you know, that is a risk we're willing to take because we believe that the withdrawal of American forces from Iraq will reap enough benefits to outweigh the impact of potential chaos and in that part of the world. And I don't just mean benefits to us. I mean benefits of stopping the occupation and stopping the war against Islam, which to some degree I would think will deflate the nature of the extremism that is mobilizing against us.
I thank you very much for joining us here in Los Angeles, William Arkin.
Thank you very much, Ian, for having me on.
Bye-bye. And hello again, I'm Ian Masters. I'm just speaking then with William Arkin, who is a columnist for The Washington Post. He's NBC's military analyst, and he's the author of Codenames, Deciphering U.S. Military Plans, Programs, and Operations in the 9/11 World. I thank the producer, Louis Vandenberg, the associate producer, Rusty Wynn, the assistant producer, Carol Coote, and the engineer, Mark Maxwell.